Our featured BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders for this episode are Gift of Life Marrow Registry, International Justice Mission, Lupus Foundation of America. To find out more about these and other BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charities, go to give.org.
You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor. Today, we're going to do something a bit unusual on the podcast, although we do a lot of unusual things on this show. But today, I'm going to actually speak with a few retired, or I should say, senior executives in major corporations who are now transitioning after many years in corporate America to their next roles. And they're very curious about the nonprofit space. And so I was asked by my friend Michelle Evans, who founded an organization to work with these executives on their transformation. Michelle asked me if I would come and speak with them about the nonprofit sector and perhaps answer some of the questions that they have about the nonprofit sector. So we're going to cover that conversation today, and you'll actually hear it. We're going to replay parts of it so that you can hear some of the questions that they had and some of my responses. But let me just tell you a little bit about the people, the individuals who are on this particular show. Michelle Evans, as I mentioned, is the former HR head for global sales at Facebook. And now, as I mentioned, she has founded this organization called Next Waves, which works with executives who are transitioning to other roles. Also on the call, Frank Knox was the senior manager of operations for CarMax. Roberto Palmarca was the enterprise risk management lead at Microsoft and formerly was the CFO of Microsoft Latin America. Luis Marcelo Murray spent 28 years at Microsoft, and when he left, he was the chief transformation and strategy officer for Microsoft Latin America. And Sharon O'Mara spent 16 years at Apple, where she was senior director of worldwide product marketing, business, education, and healthcare at Apple. So these are quite accomplished executives that I'll have a chance to talk with. And I believe you'll find their questions thought-provoking.
So Art was just saying that he was at Microsoft for the nonprofit summit.
Yeah, that was, so we have a lot of Microsoft X's here.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard Smith speak. What's his first name?
Brad Smith, he's so impressive.
Brad, yeah.
Brad Smith, yeah.
Yeah, first time I heard Brad speak. And he was impressive. And the thing that impressed me most about him was he spent about, I want to say 35 minutes or so speaking, maybe a little longer. And he spent, I would say, a good 7-8 minutes talking about the origins and significance of the nonprofit sector.
Wow.
including his own work with a couple of organizations in the Pacific Northwest out there. And he talked about how our country was formed by people who didn't necessarily have a sense of government. They had more of a sense of community, building things together, solving problems together, and forming and organizing when they needed to achieve something, right? And it had less to do with government. And how this has persisted so much so that when de Tocqueville came from France to take a look at how Americans operated, he was blown away by how many associations there were. There were all kinds of associations that enabled us to accomplish important work that the marketplace or government wasn't really in a position to help with. And the reason I thought it was so important for him to recount that is that we're seeing a dramatic decline in the amount of citizens actually participating in nonprofits. Even though the number of organizations is growing and the number of people putting money in funds like donor advised funds continues to grow, there's a lot of wealth there. The amount of money going to nonprofit organizations is in decline. And there's a serious decline in the number of people actually donating or volunteering money to nonprofit organizations. We're talking like 66% 20 years ago, roughly, to now somewhere around 49.5%. That kind of decline. And if that were to continue, you can extrapolate out another 20 years, it would be a very different country than what we know today. Even organizations, I just joined the advisory board of the Salvation Army, United States. And those kettles are like bellwethers for philanthropy in our country. Because everybody, you go to a store and you take a few dollars out and you stick it in the kettle. You don't know where it's going, but that's another story. But we've come to appreciate, well, this is what we do. You got some change, you put it in the kettle. They're down both in participation and in actual dollars. And it's a trend there. United Ways are very different.
Driver, what's the driver, Art?
Oh, the driver is, I think there's some things happening in our culture. But I also think that there's the machines, the engines that we had that powered the receipt of large amounts of small donations are changed. They're gone. So we used to have the United Way. I'd say used to. We still have the United Way. It still does great work. But it used to go into a company like Microsoft and say, in departments, you should be competing against other departments to see how much participation you can get. Right? And you don't do that anymore. Maybe they still do it at Microsoft because I know Bill Gates was a big United Way person. His mother was a big United Way person. But many companies use technology now. And the difference is that you don't have the peer pressure of a boss coming around saying to you, our department has to beat the next department. And religion is another big driver of small donations. Well, people aren't attending services across the board to the extent that they were 25 years ago. We're seeing declines in attendance. And some people say that it's not simply attendance, it's also our spirituality to some extent is in decline. And it's the values that come out of that that also drive people to give. Well, I argue that it's mostly going. I think going is a big deal because you have a plate going around, or you have a minister of some sort saying we should be giving. You have sermons that talk about the importance of giving back. You have all of this that goes on in a religious environment. And if people aren't going, they aren't hearing that. And young people aren't going because they're going to soccer on Sunday or Saturday, or whatever day you would go to your religious service. So there used to be this thing called the combined federal campaign where federal employees would do a similar thing as United Way does and all the federal agencies. That thing is a shell of what it used to be because they don't push it anymore. So many of the large drivers of small donations are gone. So people are left to decide on their own, should I give to something or should I not? where we're seeing people continue to give to disasters because they get attention in the media, but you wonder how long that's going to continue because we're seeing so many disasters and people at some point feel like, okay, I can't give anymore. So we're trying to figure out, I'm part of something called the Generosity Commission that's trying to figure out what we can do from a policy standpoint and from a culture standpoint to get people thinking differently about giving. Because as Brad said, it's a key part of the success of our democracy. Now, Brad used this framing to talk about why it's so important for us to be human-centered in how we deploy AI. Basically saying these tools need to be available to nonprofit organizations, and they need to be available at a scale, and they need to be accessible across the board, regardless of what the size of the organization is. And at least I think that's what he was intimating. But that framing has a lot to do with creating ethical AI and human-centered AI, because key to, I think, making sure that that happens is nonprofit organizations. And if we're not a part of this whole evolution, then there's a problem. So I just wanted to tell you all how impressed I was with him that he led off with that. For a corporate executive, I think it's a bit unusual. I'm hopeful that it's a symbol that AI won't be seen as simply a money grab, a way for companies to make more money and create larger wealth gaps. It will be, but I'm hoping that at least the intention of it is to make sure that it's being used to help people be more enhanced and effective in what they're doing. So if you're human-centered, you're going to be thinking about, okay, what's the impact on jobs if we deploy this technology, right? What's the impact on, and if you're interested in that, you're going to be concerned about, do we involve people in the creation of these tools so that we can really understand how we can enhance them, not replace them? And I think all of that is really critical. We're going to be thinking about how do we protect people's data and not abuse their data so that they get nothing when we use it and we get everything. You know, are the tools that we're creating for good as opposed to for evil? Are we supporting regulation that would, in some ways, curb the ability of these tools to actually hurt people? Are we training people so that they can use them effectively? Are we thinking about making sure that people across the globe who lack resources to even have internet, for instance, are we doing anything to contribute to creating that? Now, I have some issues with that too. As an aside on that one, I would say my issue is, should we superimpose our growth mentality on the entire globe? So I don't know. I think that's an important question. Yeah. I mean, I don't, just because we don't have electricity. I mean, the Amish in Pennsylvania don't believe in electricity. Should we be forcing it on them, or should we be like making a case for them to use it? No. That's how they want to live. They should be able to live that way.
I always think about the fact that, like, when Art and I got on this call, I was like, Art, I feel like you're just like a step ahead of me on everything AI. But I don't think it's an accident, right? Like, I think the people that I see that are embracing AI right now are people that are in positions where resources are constrained. And how many boards are you on, Art?
Every night I try to pray for all of the organizations that I'm involved with, and I always miss one.
It's too many to
I
count.
think about 11 right now. So,
And in other words, you can't count them all on your fingers. And then you're CEO of Give.org, and then you're a lecturer, and then you have your podcast. And every time I talk to you're remarkably zen. So I feel like you're like a perfect case. And then you think about extrapolating that across other nonprofits. Like, do you think that nonprofits are going to disproportionately benefit from AI, especially knowing that participation is down and that sort of thing?
yeah, I think they could, but it's like everything else. You have to invest some time in learning the tools and using them and thinking about how they can best help your organization. So I think there'll be an imbalance until AI becomes ubiquitous. which is happening more rapidly probably than we think. You
What do
know,
you mean bigger? What does that
so
mean?
right now we would never get in a car without using GPS to go somewhere, right? We
Right.
didn't know where we were going.
Right.
It's ubiquitous. You know,
Right.
we don't even think about it. We just say, all right, turn on maps or whatever program we use to get from point A to point B. And I just think that these tools, these AI tools, will be equally embedded in our lives such that we don't even think about them. And I think that's coming. It's probably coming more rapidly than we think. It may be generational. 5 years ago, we didn't think about virtual meetings in a way that we do today, but
Totally.
something that happened, right? And we needed to find a way to connect because we couldn't do it in person. And next thing you know, everybody's on Zoom and everybody knows what Zoom is. And you have a computer or a phone, you're able to do meetings virtually, whether it's Teams or Zoom or some other platform. We're all using these digital tools that way. And I also think that that increased the use of video tools in general. So if you want to do recordings and editing, I'm doing video editing now. I never thought I would be doing video editing.
Right.
Who would have thought you'd be doing video editing?
Yeah.
I have this program I use called Filmora. I'm getting pretty good at it. You know, I can do take a video, and if I don't like it, I can cut it and edit it and put it together and put music behind it and other features and pictures and text. And these tools are getting easier and easier to use and less expensive. So I think
Yeah.
that we're all going to be enhanced by these things. Now you can do text. As you saw, I'm using text to speak, right? I can take a text now, put it in a digital avatar, and have it send a message out for me. These are things that are happening in the availability, right? My son just created a software as a service program.
Staff.
Yeah, so if you're looking for a job, right? One of the things you're struggling with, everybody wants a cover letter. Or you got to sort through the job descriptions to see where your experience aligns with the particular job. Well, he's got a program now that all you have to do is put your resume in, put the job in, and it'll tell you what skills in your resume seem to be embedded with that particular job. And then it'll write a cover letter for you based on that. So now a person looking for a job can do hundreds more than they would have done.
Totally, I've seen it. It's
So,
amazing.
yeah.
Yeah.
You can just imagine that these things are going to continue to happen now that this tool is deployed. And at some point, it'll just become an everyday part of our life. That's what I mean by ubiquitous.
Hey, Art, speaking of boards,
Yeah.
you're so many that you can't count. I noticed there it seems to be a bit of a disconnect between people's expectations of what it's like to be on a board and then the reality of what it's like to be on a board. And a lot of time I've talked to a lot of people that are finding their next chapter, and probably 8 out of 10 people I talk to are like, oh, I'm going to be on a board, you know? And then that number gets down as people go through next waves, that number gets down to like 1 out of 10 people. Once they realize like, oh, the amount of time, you know, how little money, the politics, right? Like everything that goes into it. I know we could keep on going on about like, hey, these are
No.
the that are wrong with being on a board, but can you tell us the highlights? You know, what's
Well, it's
the good thing about being on a
there's always going to be these moments because the organizations that I would encourage you to be on are boards that are struggling, where there's a need for change and the organization is looking to improve. And so there's going to be those moments of tension, those moments of maybe not so much fun, and it's not ceremonial, it's real work. And so what I would say is you have to come and be all in. Otherwise, it's better to be 1 out of 10. Yeah. But I would also say this, and this is just how I operate in general. One of the reasons I'm on so many boards is that I give people what I think I have to offer. And I'm very clear about that. So I wouldn't recommend that anyone do what I'm doing, be on so many. But the reason I can be on so many is that I have so much experience and I understand nonprofits. It takes me a lot less time to understand what's going on in an organization than it does you. And that I'm not smarter than you or anything like that. It's just
I think
I
I'd
have
be a
a lot
little bit
more
smarter.
experience. Well, I have a lot more experience. And I've been around these organizations. I know some of the problems they have. I've seen how we create solutions for them. I've been through it for the last 30 some years. So for me, it's like second nature. For you, though, you're going to have to get involved with an organization and learn it, right? You're going to have to learn the mission, what they're doing, why they do it that way, what they're trying to achieve from an outcome. You're going to have to learn some of their problems. What are their opportunities? Where are they stuck? All those things. You got to learn the culture of the board and the organization. Is it a culture where the board is really active and engaged in the operations? Is it one where you're just providing mostly oversight and some generative ideas? These are all things that you're going to have to learn as part of being on a nonprofit board. So it's not all going to be fun. And I just think that when you set out to join a nonprofit board, you have to be mindful of that and ready. And because I always say the biggest problem we have with the future and the biggest thing that creates disappointment is not being prepared for it. I'm trying to say to you, be prepared. Come and be ready to deal with a certain degree of mess and just decide what your mess threshold is. But I'll also say that nonprofits need people who understand how corporations work. We really need them. We don't see enough of you around the table. We really need that. We see mostly other nonprofit people sitting on nonprofit boards or simply wealthy people who have, that's fine, and we need that too, who have a perspective on what a nonprofit should achieve from an impact standpoint, and they want to drive that, what I've seen in general. So what I'm suggesting is we need people who are skilled in managing corporations. Doesn't mean that everything you do or did translates in the nonprofit space. So I'd ask you to be patient about that because nonprofits don't start out in a department kind of the way a lot of you do, right? You come to a job and everything is there. Not everything, but you fight internally to build your budget and to get your team in place. But you're not out there wondering whether you're going to have money next year or next month for that matter to keep something going. Maybe you do, I don't know, but I'm sure a lot of you didn't have that. So be patient with them as they deal with these things. Don't assume that because you wrote a 5-year plan, it's going to go just like you suggested it would, because there's going to be many more challenges facing that organization. Most nonprofits have to raise everything they're going to spend in that year. And that's not easy to do. So just some points.
Roberto.
Yeah, thanks, Art. This is very, very enlightening. I just wanted to check on, for follow up on your point of skills or traits that you observe in people that come from this corporate America type of style that you saw successful. Like you mentioned the preparation, the be ready for surprises, but what would be like maybe two or three traits that you observe that bring success for people that come from that environment like us?
First, listening. Really important. Be willing to just listen. Second is engage, right? Find time to engage with the leader of the organization to let them know that you're not here to take over, because we sometimes will feel like, okay, this person's coming from a multinational company. They know so much. They're going to try to tell me to do everything differently than I've been doing. And that's scary. So you don't want we, nobody wants to be around that. So engage, but engage in a way that a person can swallow. Be supportive, tell them you want to be helpful, ask them if there's a project that you need them to be supportive of. So those kinds of things, right? I would also say study the field that the organization is involved in. It's easy to go to a board and just listen to what you hear and not have a broader context. And that's a problem. You need that context. You need to understand what are we dealing with? What's the extent of the problem that we're trying to address here? And then you can bring some unique perspectives based on your lived and worked experience to that broader issue. Encourage the organization and the CEO especially to be focused on the future and not the daily grind that they're in. Executives need space, which we don't often get, to think about what happens 5 years from now and how does that affect our organization today. You might even have some tools that they can use to better do that, right? And if you see particular things that you think might be helpful based on your work experience or your life, put that out there. And don't forget, obviously, the big one is fundraising. Nobody wants to hear that, but fundraising is huge in nonprofits. You may not be a fundraiser, but you have contacts. And if you're not willing to share your contacts with those organizations, then maybe you shouldn't be on that board. And I'm not saying you should be willing to do that on day one, but you should be willing to host events with other people like in your networks. You should be willing to introduce the executive director to people who can be helpful. You should be willing to recruit other board members from similar or different types of backgrounds who would respect you because of your positioning, right, in the corporate sector. You have to use your influence, be willing to use your influence to drive the success of the organization. So those are just some things. Helpful, Roberto?
No, this is very helpful. Thanks.
So
Very
helpful.
broad perspective. That the piece of fundraising is key, right? I recall like a friend of mine that was member of a board of a very large nonprofit in the US, and now I recall that the main struggle that he mentioned was the point of fundraising, right? It's not just like being an excellent executive, but you need to bring to the table that ability of connecting.
Yeah, that's it. And a lot of times it may not be you asking, although that's better if you would ask, but it may be opening the door for an ask to get made, right? And making sure that you're giving them as many opportunities to raise money as possible. Because look at it this way. If a person's been in the nonprofit sector, chances are they won't know a whole lot of really wealthy people because they've been in the nonprofit sector around moderately income earning people, or in many cases, even poor people. So, your connections, your contacts, the world that you've operated in is very different than a lot of nonprofit professionals and leaders. They need that. They need your willingness to open those doors and bring them in and get them exposure and get the mission exposed.
I want to go to Pew, but I gotta
Right.
say one thing that's in my head is what you're not saying that you want from what you would not want to see. And these are the things I'm noticing. You haven't mentioned like driving for results, right? You haven't mentioned like, metrics. You haven't mentioned like all the stuff that we're so comfortable with. It's like leave that behind a little bit, right?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say it's irrelevant because, and the reason I'll mention that is this. I have a perspective on the whole metrics game. It's certainly important to measure. So I'm not saying that, but we got to measure the right things. And you can't inundate an organization with measure, measure, measure. They don't have time for that. They're just trying to get a product out or a service out the door. They're just trying to do it. Now, there should be some things that we measure. The other thing is, it's hard to value a nonprofit organization based on its metrics because we don't have anything to compare it to. If you're dealing, for instance, with an organization that's trying to work with, so let's say you're trying to get kids back into school who dropped out. In Philadelphia, in the last, I learned during COVID, like 20,000 kids have dropped out and aren't coming back. 20,000. Okay, a nice metric would be to get 100% of them back in school. What's the chance of that one nonprofit organization doing that? So
Zero.
what is a good number? Is it 10%? Is it 5%? Should we calibrate it based on the amount of revenues that we have? The lagging indicator is kids back in school, that number. But we also have to look at some of the leading indicators. Are we doing the right kind of work to get there? Are there things that we could be doing that might get more kids into school, right? Is our program the right program? Those are some of the questions I think we need to ask. Whether we actually got the kid to go, it's too late to know, right? But we need to make sure we understand what we should be doing along the way to getting those kids back in school. And we have to base it on the amount of resources that we have. So we could set a goal and say, we want to get half of those kids back in school next year. But the program that we are running costs so much that it wouldn't be possible for us to reach that many kids unless we got a lot more money. So you have to keep that kind of thing in mind. And finally, nonprofits generally are trying to do things that the marketplace has said, nah, we're not going to get involved in that because we don't think there's a way to make money on it. And the nonprofits are saying, well, something has to be done. So we're going to try our best to do something. And a lot of times they just fail. They fail because it's hard to do. But maybe in trying, they're giving us hope that someday we can actually do that. So never eliminate the hope equation. And I just want to make sure that in our quest for metrics and results, we don't drive out hope. We don't crowd out hope and the importance of that from an organizational standpoint. I know that may sound really odd to people who are like in, hard-nosed business people. Sharon's got to get those phones out. Nobody wants to hear. They want to know, Sharon, how many phones did we sell this month? They don't care about what you did before. They want to know about those phones getting out. But in a nonprofit, it's also about how we go about doing it. It's about making sure that the people we touch have a good experience and making sure that the employees don't feel so overwhelmed with this enormous burden that they've agreed to take on.
A great
And so
point.
it's a lot more to it. And I don't know how to really help you appreciate it any more than that. You have to kind of
We
be.
literally said at Microsoft, didn't we, Roberto? Like, hope is not a strategy.
Yeah.
That
Yeah, right. There you go.
was
See? But it is a strategy in nonprofits.
Yeah, that's the
It is a
takeaway.
strategy.
And now it's time for our giving tips segment with Bennett Weiner, one of the world's most renowned experts on charity accountability and the COO of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance.
So today I'd like to talk a little bit about the responsibilities of serving on a charity's board of directors. And that brings to mind what I would call three different duties of a board member. One is the duty of loyalty, where the decisions that you make on the board really have to be with the charity's mission in mind. That should be the driving force as to what leads you to the right conclusions when you're making decisions in the boardroom. The other thing a charity board member should keep in mind is the duty of care. You are, to some extent, a stand-in for the donor, and you need to be wise in the use of the charity's resources in terms of its finances and spending the money as appropriately in order to address what the charity was created to do. And, that, of course, is going to mean looking over budgets, looking over your finances, making sure you're on track, and making adjustments as needed. That's an important part of the duty of care, and also to be free of conflict of interest that may result because of a board member-related or staff member-related transaction. And the third thing would be the duty of obedience. And what I mean by that is you're going to want to follow the articles of incorporation, bylaws, and whatever appropriate government regulations impact that particular organization. You want not only to be a good charity citizen, but you want to make sure that you are in line with how you were organized to address these issues. And those governing instruments were created for a reason, to provide some structure and responsibility in terms of a track to maintain in carrying out your duties and responsibilities. So those three things, duty of loyalty, duty of care, and duty of obedience, are important considerations when serving on a charity's board of directors.
Pio, what's your, I would love to hear your question.
Before the question, just one comment. As you were mentioning, the hard time having to capture funds and fundraising, I remember a very nice book. It's called Good to Great. Then there's a version of Good to Great for social companies. It's a very short one, like 50 pages. And there is one comment there that struck to me, especially for us coming from the business world, is that in the nonprofit, typically there is a disconnect between the mechanisms that capture money and the mechanism that spends money. In a company, you produce more products, you spend more money. You sell more, you get money. In the nonprofit, there is no correlation between the way you get the money and the way you spend the money. So that's very different from a business perspective trying to operate in this scenario.
Yeah, and some of us are struggling with that too. So this is a great point you brought up, which is you can't raise money without spending money. But somehow or another in the nonprofit space, we have a sense that if we spend too much on fundraising, nobody will like us. But if, let's say you started a nonprofit and you wanted to do what I just said, get kids in Philadelphia back in school. The first few years, unless some wealthy donor just came in and socked some money on you, you're going to have to find a way to get money. And you have to spend some to do it. So you're going to have to find, let's say you were able to get a donor to give you, I don't know, let's say $100,000. The question is, should we be spending that $100,000 on fundraising, or should we try to take that $100,000 and maybe get 30 kids back in school? Some people will argue that you would be smarter to take that $100,000 and try to raise $500,000. And now you can get 30 times five, what is that? 150 kids back in. While others are like in the nonprofit sector, no. If you spend more than 20% of that money on fundraising, there's something wrong with you.
Interesting.
Well, what can you do? You can't do any fundraising with $20,000. I'm sorry. There's no system you can buy with $20,000 that's actually going to do any fundraising. But that's what donors will expect. And if you went back to that donor and that donor said to you, you said, well, what did you do with my $100,000? Did you get any kids back in school? And you said, no, we put all your money into fundraising so we could raise. The donor would probably be upset. And they would like, well, we wanted to get kids back in school. So the only thing you can say to that donor at that point is, well, unless you want to be the only donor to our organization, we had to put it into fundraising. Maybe they'll understand. And by the way, the fact that you spent the $100,000 on fundraising doesn't mean that you're actually going to raise more.
It's like a whole new rule book.
I'm telling you, it's hard. It's hard. For you guys from companies, you just go raise your Series A, your Series B, or whatever it is, whatever series you're in. Right? I'm not saying it's easy to do that. I mean, there's a skill in getting people to give you money, too. Or you go to the market and say, give us some money to do this thing. There is no market. We have to convince people or foundations or something to give us money.
I love the way you talk about activists. And I have never, because one of the things I'm involved in some nonprofits, and I'm like, I just assume some things are going to be like, so like no controversy, right? Like, oh yeah, sounds, you know, and then sure enough, there's always controversy. And I'm like, whoa, where did this come from? And I've learned more and more about activism from you and the important role of activists. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, I think that activism is what gets attention, but it doesn't solve problems. And that's the distinction I would draw. Mm-hmm. We need institutions that are going to work on problems over a long period of time to actually solve problems. But today, everybody wants to be an activist and say that they're having impact. I'm an activist, too. I like to get out there and talk about things that I think are wrong in society. And I like to poke criticism at people who I think are doing things the wrong way in institutions. But in that work, we have to make sure that we're pushing institutions to change rather than tearing them down. And then we have to be willing to say, well, what is it that we think should be changing? Mm-hmm. Right? What do we want to see that's different in these institutions so that we could be more supportive? But I just think that there are some people who are just serially critics. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's a place for that too. But an organization has to be able to listen and ferret out people who are just criticizing because that's what they do versus people who really have something valuable to offer in the way of change. Mm-hmm. And that is, Michelle, the distinction. I think we all in us have our activists, but I'm an institutional person. So what's happening more now is that we know more about institutions because of digital communications and transparency that we are having. There's so many different types of media now, right? We find out things that we would never have known before. And so people think that there's something different about these institutions. No, it's just that we know more about them. And that's fine. So it's once you know, now you become a critic. Now you become suspect of the organization. Now you think the organization is ineffective. It's not any more so than it was before. What we need, though, are solutions. You know, if the American Red Cross isn't delivering disaster relief the way you think it should, that's one thing. Well, what should it be doing? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, let's find out what it is doing and why, so that we can fix it. But let's not tear the Red Cross down. There's nothing like the Red Cross. You kidding me? So here we go. Let's start with this example. I'll never forget when the Red Cross was doing disaster relief for, I think it was in Texas. There was a hurricane or something that hit Texas. And there was a woman on TV who brought like a box of hamburgers that she wanted to hand out to people who were, she thought, were hungry as a result of not having any food. And she wanted to have the Red Cross distribute these hamburgers. Well, the Red Cross can't just take hamburgers from some random person and distribute them to folk who are in need. They can't do that. And as soon as somebody got sick from one of those hamburgers, what do you think would happen to the Red Cross?
Yeah. Right?
It would be irresponsible. So now the next thing you know is, the TV reporters are blasting that the Red Cross refuses to feed people who are hungry.
Wow.
Which is total nonsense.
Total nonsense.
We get to see that because this woman took a film of the Red Cross person saying, I can't take these hamburgers, and now it's a big thing. And that's all we see, right? So we wouldn't have seen that 30 years ago. This wouldn't even have been part of our understanding. But it is now. And so now we think the Red Cross is ineffective.
Yeah.
And that's not to say the Red Cross is doing everything perfectly. It's not. There are certainly things that it can improve on. But we see these things and suddenly it creates an impression of an institution that is really, that really lacks context.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I think we tend to be critical of institutions.
Mm-hmm.
That's my problem. So activists get more attention. It's easier for them to do that. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have that, but I am saying sometimes people need to take a beat and make sure that they are getting the full picture of what's going on. Hopefully they'll start doing that. I don't know.
Any questions for Art? I was going to switch topics a little bit, but I don't want to.
No, let's do it. I know I give long answers, so shorten me.
I like your long answers, though. Go ahead, Roberto.
No, you mentioned the subject of ethics of AI, and this is very close to my heart, given my previous work at Microsoft. We used to have like quarterly meetings with Brad Smith talking about this subject as part of risk, even mentioning that like 5 years ago before OpenAI or ChatGPT existed, right? So I understand how is this top of mind for him. And maybe an idea for another board for you, but I'm just curious, what would be like ideas of, you mentioned how nonprofit could help, right? And I always remember Brad mentioning the point of regulation, right? And how the self-regulation, for example, right? So I'm just curious, would be that an opportunity beyond the impact that you mentioned of AI in the nonprofit, but actually for some role of nonprofit that is not government, that is not corporate, but something in the middle that the nonprofit sector could help on that piece of like self-regulation or something like that?
I think the best way to regulate would be through some type of nonprofit organization. It has to be self-regulated. I don't think government can keep up.
They can't.
I don't think they can keep up. And that doesn't mean a self-regulatory body could either. But the self-regulatory body would have to have some heft, right? It would have to involve those who are creating the technology as well as those who are using their technology and people who, frankly, are maybe somewhat skeptical of the technology, right? You'd have to have all of that come together so that you got a full picture of what the issue is and what the challenges are. But I don't see how government can do it. And I don't understand. We can't even get a budget out. How are we going to regulate something that changes every second? Every second there's a new AI product coming out. I mean,
Always.
I'm just exaggerating, of course,
I
but
don't think you
I'm
are.
not.
I think it's that fast. Jason and I went to brunch with a couple that were visiting from DC, and she's in something in the Hill. You probably know better than me, Art, but she was on a literally on like the House committee for AI. And Jason and I were like, oh, of course, right? ChatGPT, blah, 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 oh my God, I'm using it, da, da, da. And she's like, oh, I've never used it. And it was like, what? And then she's like, well, it's, because I have concerns. And I was like, I don't think you get the luxury of sitting this out if you're like involved at a governmental level on AI regulation. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, but that's what we elected them to do. Nothing apparent. So, Michelle, I think it and Roberto, I would love to see a body created, maybe sanctioned by government even, right? And governments, we shouldn't just say it, because that's the thing I struggle with sometimes, Roberto, is if America says, here are what we're going to do, and if the European Union sees it differently and they are more strict and we're less strict, products come out over here, they're going to creep across. I mean, I don't know how we say that global companies operate differently in different places and expect that's always going to solve the problem. I don't, because the technology doesn't care about national boundary, it seems to me. But there was something interesting happened yesterday, so maybe it can be stopped. I couldn't get a cell signal. I have AT&T and I couldn't get a cell signal yesterday. Were you all the same? That blew my mind. That actually blew my mind that it was across the country. It's like somebody pulled a plug and that was it. How did that happen?
Well, and Art, isn't there a concern, and maybe this is in the same space as regulation, isn't there a concern that something like that happened? I was talking to my daughter, and she's like, God, I'm glad that didn't happen when I was out and about, because if I were somewhere, the first thing I'd do is plug in my phone to Waze for navigation. I would have been lost, right? And I thought about that for a moment, and as we're talking about AI, you think about that and you say, so many people, if we start gravitating too far and we swing that pendulum so far to the right, where everyone's leaning on AI, all the kids are leaning on AI, all it takes is something like that to happen and it all comes to a screeching halt. Everything stops, right? Like I'm like even today I'm playing around and there's something going on with my computer where my Chat GPT isn't working on my computer, but it's working on my phone. I don't know what the deal is, but it's throwing my day off. And so you look at that and you wonder from a charitable position, there's got to be something out there that says, look, we need something that regulates not just for adults, but for our children, that they're not leaning strictly on this. Like, they need to stay educated to a degree and still be able to use AI to enhance that. And I don't know if there's anything out there, and I don't know that there's enough conversations around that just yet. I know the universities, some universities, my sister's a college professor, and they've been using AI more, but they've been using it more to catch the students that are using it to write their papers.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that's pretty reductive usage of it. But I agree. I think we are redefining what it is to be educated. And the way I think about it is, I think I'm a decent writer. Not great, but I can put a document out and you'd be able to understand what I was saying. But I've never really understood all the parts of speech. So, you know, I struggle kind of in English class because I know what a noun is. I know what a verb, but then you start to get into pronouns and what it is. I don't know. I don't understand the differences. I just can't see it, right? My mind just doesn't allow me to understand the differences. I don't need to. Now I really don't need to.
That's what I figured.
You really don't need to.
I really don't need. So all of the things that, Frank, you were talking about, that was what they tried to teach us in school. Those were fundamentals in being able to write well, understanding that stuff, right? We don't need that anymore. What we need are ideas, and then the thing will help us communicate those ideas, right?
Yeah.
So the other thing I've been thinking about this some, what do we want out of education? Ultimately, I think, and this is still evolving, so don't hold me to this, but I think we want people who can solve problems, who can work collaboratively, who are innovative, and who can be self-sufficient. And we want people who can communicate across difference.
Yeah.
How about that as an objective, right, for our society? I think we almost have to read. It's not really even about work skills anymore.
Yeah.
We should say, well, we need kids to be able to come out and be good in the workplace. Well, we still don't know what jobs we want. I don't know. A kid entering first grade today, what are we telling this kid that we want you to grow up and be?
Yeah, we don't even know what jobs are going
to be. No clue.
It's so true, isn't it? Yeah, it's like, I guess you can still be a fireman.
Until we have machines that go out and put fires out.
Totally.
No, it'll be somebody sitting behind a console and they put the machines in and they go put the fire out.
Well, that's a fact, right? Like, you think about the robotics industry that's coming along, you think about infusing that with AI.
In my county, just this week, three volunteer firefighters were injured or killed.
Wow.
In a house fire. That should never, that will never, that's You're gonna right. go away. That's that has to go away.
Sharon has a question. All right, I just want to make sure she gets her
question. Sharon, go ahead, Sharon. Please ask your question.
No worries. I was just thinking, it's more of an observation, because when you were talking, I got online and thought, you know, you said something about people aren't participating in nonprofits and that the drop off is so significant.
Yeah.
And I just thought, in this conversation around AI is a part of it, we're losing our connection. So I got online socially and I went in to see, like, what is the United Way on Instagram followers just in Silicon Valley? It's less than 1,000 people.
Are you serious?
And then, And then I got on and looked at Red Cross has, you know, about 300,000. I'm rounding. Yeah. And then Salvation Army was really low as well. They don't have local, like, United Way. You can find that. And I was just thinking, like, we're just so losing our connection. But then I thought of something, which is I follow national parks and on Instagram because they're hysterical.
They really
they're
are.
Funny. They are connecting to me in a way that's like, they're, you know, it's that connection. Now, not everybody can do that. I follow another nonprofit that's called Room to Read because I like their charter and very much, and I know some of their executives. But it's this idea of like connection, and it just feels like something is so missing to me there. And I see like my kids. I have high school seniors, and they have to volunteer. And the problem with the have to volunteer is they can't wait to get done with it.
Right.
And my kids will probably never go back to what is in our area, the Second Harvest, which is a food service, which by the way, is a fantastic service. It's effective. It's like, it's huge, but they won't get back to it because there's no connection to it. And I even just looked at Red Cross, and I'm just trying to think, like, this is one of the things, like, if I were part of a nonprofit, I would be like, what is my connection to who I'm trying to not only help, but create those connections so that we are help, people can figure out how to be involved and help each other. I don't know if there's trends around that you guys are paying attention to, or, you know, things that we could do to help around that. But that to me is like what strikes me out of this conversation.
Look, you're dead on, but nonprofits aren't good at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we're good at feeding people.
But did you think the National Parks was good at it? You know, No. Like if I would have thought about it, I would have been like, National Park Services? Are you kidding me? I mean, have you talked to rangers? Like, no.
Right. And some are. I mean, there's some groups, obviously. But by and large, we don't spend enough on marketing. We don't spend enough on communications. If you think United Way is low, you should go look at some of the other nonprofits that are nowhere near as well-heeled. They don't spend enough resources on that. And with regard to social media, we tend to, let's see if we can find some intern or volunteer to kind of do our social media. Right. But it's not really that well thought out. It's not focused on bringing more people in.
Imagine if you said to a school, if you created a committee of kids who were our social media and they were required to do this over their 4 years, then that's their social, like that's it, right?
That could work. That could work, right? I mean, that would be the kind of thing where a nonprofit would be innovative. The school could ask the kids to do something that they are clearly able to do and they're accustomed to doing, right? So maybe something like that could work. But in a nonprofit, we also want to make sure, I'm just looking at it from their perspective, we want to make sure that it's a consistent and ongoing kind of program. So as kids roll off, we've got to be able to roll more kids, right? And so there's got to be some...
Yeah.
So that means they have to have training. They would have to set up a function within the nonprofit to make sure that that continued and was successful, you know, in the long run. Some nonprofits would say, "Well, we need a body. We need a person to actually be responsible for that. And where's the money going to come from for that? Oh, so it's not a good idea. Look, there's a lot of resistance to change too in nonprofits. I'm not going to say, and we got to get over that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. The nonprofit that I'm part of, we were going to bring in an intern to do TikTok. And I was sitting there in the meeting like, oh, this is great. And then all of a sudden the room's like, well, you know, TikTok's owned by a Chinese company. Da, da, da. Next thing you know, that was dead in the water. I was like, whoa, what happened? I thought that was a good idea. Oh my gosh, I want to be respectful of Art's time because
you are. I mean, I'm loving this, so don't worry.
Okay, great, because I love it too. And by the way, like every time I get on the phone with Art, this is like, these are our conversations. How wonderful is this? And I feel like we've barely scratched the surface. Like there's so much we could talk about. If you were going to like wave a magic wand, Art, and be like, okay, next waves, these are accomplished professionals. You know, what's one step you would want people to take?
In terms of nonprofits or just in general?
Well, I'd love to hear both. I was thinking nonprofits, but now I'm curious what you're thinking.
Well, I mean, you are all very successful people, so you don't really need me to tell you what you should be doing next. But one of the things I would say is just continue to learn. Michelle and I are part of this thing called Roar Into Your Next Life, the thing that our friend Michael Clinton has started about what happens after the age of 50, when maybe you've retired from one thing and you're moving into something else. And Michael is very adamant that we're going to live another 30, 40 years. And what are you going to do with that time? You know, we should be thinking about being very active and vital and contributing members of our society. Maybe we can do it in a slightly different way. We don't have the pressure of producing for someone else. We can do it more on our own terms. But the bottom line is we have to think about how we want to contribute in some way to the greater good. That's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping all of you are going to take whatever you have left, which is a lot, and figure out how you can contribute to the greater good. I see that as what we're here to do. And I think you're going to be very enriched by that in different ways. You may find that by helping folk, you actually produce a business, or business comes out of that, or connections that you get ask you to do something that actually financially enriches you. But I can certainly say you're going to be enriched in other ways. And I'm kind of a spiritual person, so I know what it feels like to actually help somebody with something. And the lift you get is a dopamine thing. You know, you get that lift when you actually do something and someone says, you know, I really appreciate that. I hadn't thought about that. Or you've really helped me move the needle on this. So, you know, I love that. Teach, you know, you all a lot to share. So teach. What you've gotten the luxury of doing in your life, not many people will ever get the luxury of doing. Figure out how to put some of that out there so that other people can vicariously live that through you. Do that. There's so many young people who have no clue that there are opportunities in some of the companies that you worked for. You know, help them see some of those opportunities. Go into some schools if you can get in there. And, you know, talk to young people about some of the things that could be waiting for them if they did certain things. All of that's needed. And of course, stay connected to our organization, the Wise Giving Alliance. And definitely subscribe to the podcast, because the people that I have on that show have done amazing things and are doing amazing things. Just yesterday, Tuesday, we released the episode with a young man who tragically lost his wife to childbirth. He's African-American. His wife is African-American. And he's raising three children now without his wife. What he didn't realize at the time was that Black women are like 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth than white women. And you say, well, why is that? And there's a whole combination of factors that go into that. And now he and his mother-in-law started an organization to create more awareness around this. And they created a film called Aftershock. It's on Hulu. I commend it to you. And he started something called the Luxor Collaborative, which is a group of African-American fathers who have experienced that trauma and who are raising kids without their mothers. And I was on the Zoom with them last night, and it was unbelievable the support and love that these gentlemen were sharing and wisdom that they were giving to each other. And comfort, right? The name of the podcast is called The Heart of Giving Podcast, Sharon. The Heart of Giving. These are amazing people. And they're doing all kinds of things. I'll have the CEO of the American Red Cross on one day. And the next day, I'll have a gentleman who's just getting started with a nonprofit, but who has a huge heart. And Roberto and Frank, if you guys want to talk about hope, this is hope. He could very easily have said, I don't have any money. I don't have any influence. I don't have any contacts. I've got nothing except this hurt and this trauma that I've experienced as a result of the loss of my wife during childbirth, which could have been prevented. And I've got to do something with that. No business model works with that. Every business model would have said, I know where your heart is, but believe me, forget that. You're not going to get anywhere with that. But not him. He's saying, I got to do something with that. And so, you know, he will. He eventually will find what he needs, and that thing will succeed. It'll succeed on its own timing, but it will. So that's what I'm putting out here. That's what I'm putting out here.
Wow.
Don't think of it in terms of a business model. It's what they want to do. But the podcast is another thing. Well, I mean, I'm sorry. Sometimes I don't even appreciate how charged up I am about what I've done with my life until I get in front of people like you and I just start talking. So if I run on too much or if I'm trying to cram too much into a small space, I apologize for that. But this, the excitement that comes from wanting to deliver 30 some years of what I've experienced in a very short time.
Please don't apologize. It's our gift to hear from you. And
that's,
I know,
great.
Amazing.
Awesome. So thanks a lot.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the conversation that I had with these amazing individuals. And I hope that maybe I've convinced some of them to venture into the nonprofit sector. I think they have a lot to offer. And for all of you who are listening to this podcast for the first time, we're a weekly show and we come out every Tuesday with a new episode. If you want to support the podcast, please do so by subscribing. Of course, that's free of charge. Subscribe so that you can get every episode when they come out. And also, if you want to support the podcast financially, you can do so by going to give.org, G-I-V-E.org, and we will certainly put that money to great use. Thank you for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.